You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Magnus Shaw goes to America and meets Morgan Freeman. We read Morrissey's autobiography, The Worst TV Programme in the World is Reviewed, and we update the Pretend iPod.
Hello, everybody. Welcome again to the Parish Council, the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. Back amongst you, I'm Magnus Shaw, and he's heading up the Queen's Highway, looking like a streak of lightning. He's Terence Dackham.
Hey, wait a minute. You're not Juliet Harris.
Hold on. No, I'm not, you're right.
You're not Rona Martin.
Hold on. No, you're right, I'm not.
You're Magnus Shaw. Yes. Hello, Magnus
Shaw. Hello.
Here's the thing. Yeah. Here's the thing. You seem to have been missing for a few weeks.
Yes. I simply just forgot to attend. No, I did.
I see.
No, I didn't. I've been in the US of A. Old Glory. Yes, I have.
Did you have a good time?
It was quite astonishing, really. Did we mention, I don't know, I did a road trip from New York City to Miami.
I think you may have mentioned it once or twice.
Over 18 days, and it was as extraordinary as it ought to have been, really, and more so. Yeah, it was fantastic. 3,000 miles down the East Coast.
Now, what everybody will want to know, of course, is that before you went, we set you a target. Yep. to check out some of the food on the eastern seaboard, including the new chain of French Fry Heaven, where you can only get French fries for starter, main course and pudding.
Yes.
Did you manage to get to French Fry Heaven?
You know what?
Yes.
I did. Oh. Yes, it took me until St. Augustine, which is just south of Jacksonville in Florida. So it took me that long before I spotted one. And right in the middle of St. Augustine, the oldest town in America, there is a French Fry Heaven, yes. I thought, look. So myself and Mrs. the Magnus Shaw hauled ass into French Fry Heaven, and we went for... the garlic and herb sauce poured all over a carton of French fries. Yeah.
Was it any good?
It's amazing.
It was French Fry Heaven.
It was French Fry Heaven. Yeah. And you know, extremely low calorie and very good for you.
There's
no doubt.
Yeah.
No cream in crammed that sauce. With, no deep frying involved.
Crammed with vitamins.
Yeah, we shared one. Goodness. If that's any consolation, we shared.
Were there people? Did you manage to spend enough time there to see if people were having French fries for dessert?
No, there was nobody in there.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
There was a girl sort of propping up the counter and reconciling the till when we went in. I mean, it must have been about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so perhaps they'd had their lunchtime rush. And I chatted to her for a bit, and she said, oh, yeah, it's going like wildfire. You know, they're opening up all over the place. But we just happened to catch the place empty, so we were able to peruse the menu at our leisure. Yeah, and all the insane, well, you read them out, didn't you, combinations that you can have there. And as you rightly say, there's a dessert menu as well, which is sweet potato French fries with French vanilla cream. But we had a savoury.
What's this I hear while we're on food about you scoffing steaks like they were going out of fashion?
So, okay, as you get south, you get more and more prevalence of a chain called Golden Corral. And
right.
Golden Corral is like, you know, in the UK, if you go to a shopping centre, there's a food court.
Yeah.
Golden Corral is like a food court.
Right.
But you pay like $11 as you go in, and they give you a plate and a knife and fork and a cup, and then you can just keep going. You can just have as much of the food court as you want.
See, that's my idea.
It's just great. Now, we went on a Sunday. We've been before when we've been in the States, but we've never been on a Sunday afternoon. And on a Sunday afternoon, they charge you an extra dollar but give you access to a grill. There's a fella there grilling stuff up for you. And he was doing chicken and steak. And, 3 steaks.
Three steaks.
Yeah, probably about 10-ounce steaks, yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's surprising that you survived the day, never mind the trip.
Yeah, well, I couldn't tell whether I had meat sweats or it was just the fact that it was, like, 85 degrees outside anyway. But it, you know, it was really nice steak, you know, and you've paid $12, you know, and you could eat as much steak as you want. And it was really good stuff as well. You know? So, yeah, I had three steaks in a sitting. That's a really stupid thing to do, but there you go, yeah.
And you stayed on a reservation?
Oh, the Indian reservations, yeah.
Whoa, hold it. Aren't you supposed to say Native American reservation?
Oh, no. You can say Indian reservation because that's what they're called. I mean, that's what they're marked as on the map. But the people you have to call Native Americans, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, quite rightly, because they're not from India, you know.
No.
Or the West Indies, you know. So no. It's a complete misnomer. Yes.
How did you end up staying there?
Oh, we just booked into a hotel on the reservation. An Indian reservation isn't sort really what you expect. It's not a, you know, like half a dozen fields with teepees in it. You know, it's a town. they are towns, and it's quite sad really because. You know, the white man in his wisdom thought, well, we've got all these native people here. What are we going to do with them? You know, there's not many employment opportunities for them, et cetera, et cetera. So what they did is say, well, even in the states where gambling is illegal, we'll let them set up casinos and then they can all make a living. So they're casino towns and as tacky as you'd expect from that, you know. All centered around a casino. And, there's loads of gift shops all selling Indian or, you know, I shouldn't really say that, should I? Native American carvings and dream catchers and stuff, but it's all very sort of the tourist version of Native America, really. And, all employed by a casino. So it's far from romantic, I'm afraid, yeah.
Sort of a conclave, really, a kind of urban ghetto of some
rural ghetto, I suppose you'd call it. Yeah, I mean, the towns are very pretty because they're, certainly the one we went to, the Cherokee Reservation is set in the forests of North Carolina, you know, so surrounded by absolutely stunning landscapes, but the towns themselves are a bit sort of, you know, Blackpool with added tomahawks, really, you know, a little bit like that. So you don't feel in touch with the Native American people in any way at all, sadly, no.
And you were also hobnobbing with the rich and famous
for a few
movie
seconds.
Yeah.
So we're walking through New York City and we're looking for somewhere to have lunch. And we were sort of half lost. We walked down the wrong street, which is easy to do. The New Yorkers expect you to have the same knowledge of the city that they do. They're not big on signs particularly. And it was suddenly immediately obvious that they were shooting something. You know, they've got the flight cases out and the camera equipment and lights everywhere. And look, they're making a TV show or something. So we bowled up to go and have a look and asked a couple of the crew, look, I know you're working and I'm a, you know, pain in the butt tourist, but what are you making? So, well, we're filming a feature film for release next year. The working title was Rhythm of Life, but I bet it doesn't end up being called that. And I said, oh, yeah, anybody in it? You know, and they said, well, Diane Keaton. I said, oh, yes.
Ooh.
And said, Morgan Freeman. I said, oh, right. I said, but they're not here. You're just doing location right. I said, oh, no, they're just round the corner. So we pulled just literally round the corner, and they'd taken over a diner. I mean, good news for the owner of the diner there. So some extra income there for sure. And the second we walked round the corner, who wanders out of the diner but Morgan Freeman? I said to you, Mrs. the Magnus Shaw, it's Morgan Freeman. She goes, I know. So she pulled her cameras out and everything. And he came and stood, I don't know, 10 feet from us, you know. And so I just stepped forward and said, you know, pleasure to meet you, Mr. Freeman. I really like your work. Oh, thank you very much. He said, shook my hand. Then his assistant came over and he started chatting to her. But very unassuming. Not surrounded by, you know, gorillas in bomber jackets or anything like that, you know. Then quite reassuringly, he having spoken to his assistant, he went over and had a chat with the tech guys, you know.
Good. Yeah, that's always good. So when I've been on movie sets, and the only time that you see these stars when they are walking out of their trailer and back into their trailer.
No, not at all. He chatted to all the people he needed to talk to, and they literally walked back around the corner where we'd initially been, and off up the street and into his trailer. I mean, the street was lined with trailers, and but he didn't have to be taken in a golf buggy or anything. You know, he just strolled off to his trailer with nary a buyer or a lever. We had to head that way, so we walked down this street with the trailers, and like they start with two massive Winnebagos, one that said on the door Mr. Freeman and the next one Miss Keaton, and then they get smaller and smaller as you go down the street till you get to, you know, first assistant makeup in his little tiny little caravan, you know.
Yeah, I've often been in those ones, thank you very much.
So off we went and had lunch, a bit of shell shock, thinking, wow, we've just been talking with Morgan Freeman, shaking his hand, you know. And I think, you know, of all the people you could bump into from Hollywood, you know, Keanu Reeves or anybody wouldn't have had half the impact. But, you know, Morgan Freeman, proper movie star, you know.
Proper movie star,
yeah, yeah.
And I know you also went to see Steely Dan, but you're going to write, you've written about
that. Yeah, I went to the Beacon Theatre in New York City to watch The Dan. Yeah, that's a really good thing to do. Great. Yes, but I shall write it all up for you. Mm. Yeah.
Well, in your absence, that Stephen Morrissey has only gone and published his rather brief but beautifully rhythmic autobiography.
Yeah, I saw a lot of Twitter traffic about this.
Here's one review from Amazon that I thought we all might enjoy, from someone called AJ Wentworth, talking about Morris's autobiography. And he says, does AJ Wentworth, how does Penguin Classics justify publishing an autobiography written yesterday by a narcissistic pop star from the 80s? Whatever next, says AJ Wentworth. The memoirs of Simply Red? I cannot get a new affordable copy of Alexander Pope's translation of Homer's The Iliad, but I can get a copy of Morris's autobiography. Glad to see Penguin Classics has got its house in order. So, I don't know about you, I think there may be an acidic, kind of acerbic edge to AJ Wentworth's last sentence there, but Magnus Shaw, are you as enraged as AJ Wentworth, or is Morrissey already downloaded to your Kindle?
Oh, well, neither really. I'd happily download it to my Kindle. It's got to be an interesting read one way or the other.
It's only £4, by the way. £4
Oh, I'm there then. Yes, I'm there for that. Then it's got to be an interesting read one way or the other. I don't really understand the subtleties and politics of publishing imprints enough to be outraged. One would expect Penguin Classics to be a bit more antiquated, I suppose, you know, to cover, you know, as he says, Homer and such like, but it doesn't matter to me. You know, it's sort of like getting upset about a particular album being on a particular label. I mean, you've got to be quite a purist to get too wound up about these things. So that doesn't trouble me at all. Morrissey's autobiography is narcissistic. Who'd have thought? It'd be much more shocking if it had been a bit dull and unassuming, wouldn't it? That's what's expected. That's what we have Morrissey for, isn't it? To gawp at somebody so intertwined with themselves, they almost carry a mirror strapped to their front, you know. That's what you think. Yeah. That's what you'd expect Morrissey to be. But I'm not, having not read it, I can't really concur with the critique or not. But
Mr. AJ Wentworth,
Certainly interested.
I'm about halfway through it, apparently it gets very. He settles a lot of scores apparently in the last half, which I haven't got to yet. But the first half that I got to, it's all about his childhood and being at school. It's so beautifully written. Every page is a joy to read. The style is just magnificent. The opening two sentences I've got here, and I think they're just gorgeous. My childhood is streets upon streets upon streets. Streets to define you and streets to confine you, with no sign of motorway, freeway or highway. It's like prose poem, isn't it?
Yeah.
We live in forgotten Victorian knife-plunging Manchester, is another quote. We trudge to school ankle deep in slush, half thawed and half frozen, musing on My Boy Lollipop by Millie Small. You know, all those bits I've just read, if they'd been written by Alan Bennett, yes, people would be saying it's award worthy. You know, because exactly, I think it absolutely generates a picture, yeah, of Manchester in the 1960s.
Well, and you know what it sounds like? It sounds like a Smiths lyric, doesn't
it? It does, actually, yes. One long 200-and-something pages of Smiths
lyrics.
Which
is going to disappoint absolutely nobody. So, no. You know, I would have thought he's fulfilled his brief from that description you've given us there. So, and I think, you know, what's interesting about Morrissey is, excuse me, he doesn't have terribly many friends, but his two best friends are the aforementioned Alan Bennett and Russell Brand. And when you think about it, that makes perfect sense, because he slots somewhere between those two poles, doesn't he, really?
Yes, he does, yeah, yes. Yeah. Do you know something that struck me as I thought, well, just wanted to get a bit of a timeline back of the Smiths and Morrissey and, you know, his age when they started, when they broke up. And, of course, it's 30 years. We've had 30 years of Morrissey, which surprised me. I didn't realise it was as long as that in the sort of public, since Hand in Glove and This Charming Man in 1983. But, you know, lots of people kind of rue, don't they, the breakup of the Smiths. But it's arguable that they were in decline. And I didn't realise this until I looked up the chart placings. I looked at the last five singles when they were still a band. I'm not talking about singles that were released after they'd broken up. The last five singles when they were still together in the UK reached, respectively, as they say, in chart placings, number 10, number 13, number 23... number 30, and the last one didn't chart, right, which was Stop Me If You Think You've Heard This One Before, which is kind of, it says it all, really, because we were stopping them because we thought we'd heard it all before. So each of those last five singles each reached a lower space in the public's affections before they broke up. So, you know, people sort of, well, I certainly did thought they broke up at their magnificent best, and, you know, what a tragedy it all is. Maybe, you know, they were reaching the end of the natural road.
Yeah, I think that's quite possible. I think that's true of all the great bands, is that, you know, they spotted that they were, you know, that they peaked, you know. I was never a Smiths obsessive. I think the whole point with the Smiths is that they were there to be obsessed over, and I never did, really. There are far more Morrissey solo records that I or tracks that I like than Smith's tracks, I think, if I were to list them. But I think How Soon Is Now is a work of near genius. But things like Reel Around the Fountain and There's a Light That Never Goes Out, Girlfriend in a Coma, etc., you know, they're interesting singles of their time, but I never obsessed over them, nor over Morrissey, I have to say. But he's an interesting guy, of course, you know, and he's the kind of pop star that could only be produced by Britain, you know. That's why he's interesting. He's quintessential Englishness, you know.
Later on today, I'm going to read the second half, and I believe he's quite tough on Rough Trade and Jeff, you know, the record label Rough Trade, and Jeff Travis.
And nobody carries a grudge quite like Morrissey.
No. You know?
This is all part of Morrissey. There's no point. There's no point in saying, oh, my goodness, that Morrissey, you know, he's so vitriolic.
that's surprise.
It's rather like saying, that Wayne Rooney, you know, all he does is kick. He's always kicking a ball. What's with the guy? You know, it's what he does. It's his thing, isn't it? You know, so I think it's absurd to, you know, carp on about somebody's, the very thing that makes somebody so high profile. You know, it seems ridiculous. You know,
last quote from his childhood. My sister and I would play every day in the attic with great blocks of chalk and strips of coloured plasticine. Mother is a critical guide, and Dad is playful, although fist ready with the outside world.
Yes, well, there you go. I mean, it's clearly well written, which is all you need to ask of a book, really, isn't it?
Probably closer in values than one might immediately believe are Morrissey and Charlotte Church. Mm. And while Morrissey is settling old scores and reflecting on the past, Charlotte Church has been focusing on the present state of affairs in the music industry. delivering BBC Six Music's annual John Peel lecture, Charlotte said that the music business has a, quote, culture of demeaning women, close quote, and that she was pressurized into wearing revealing outfits when she was 19 or 20 years old. And she added in this lecture that young female artists are routinely, she says, coerced into sexually demonstrative behavior in order to hold on to their careers. So considering the Miley Cyrus twerking performance at the VMAs, Magna Shaw, is Charlotte Church right? Are women placed in a demeaning situation in the music industry?
Yes, they are. All I can say to that really is, but it was ever thus. I'm not sure Charlotte is revealing any deep hidden secrets. This was always the raison d'etre of the music industry, really, was to sell the music by any means possible. And the male psyche being what it is, that is often by showing a comely young lass in very few clothes. So I don't quite know what Charlotte's trying to tell us here. Is it a good thing? No, of course it's not. But you can't go in and sanitize the music industry of its more base excesses, really. This has been done for time immemorial. I mean, Sandy Shaw was barefooted because it hinted at nakedness, and so on and so forth, and on it goes. Debbie Harry and their sexuality was seized upon by the people promoting them, and always will be.
Last week, Annie Lennox posted a message via Twitter expressing her concern over what she calls overtly sexualized performances and videos, and she's probably referring to Miley Cyrus, Rihanna, Britney Spears, in particular their most recent videos. Now, those three ladies, Miley, Rihanna and Britney, they might well argue, I suppose with some vehemence, and because they possibly do, that they're empowering themselves. But I think, you talk about how it's always been thus. I recall the rather odd case of Annabella Lewin, who was 14. You remember 14 years old when she posed without clothing for the cover of Bow Wow Wow's album, and there was something not right about that, and that was 1981. So, of course, there's always been exploitation in the casting couch, hasn't there?
Yes, of course, and I think to get a 14-year-old to pose naked on the front of an album, I mean, it just wouldn't fly today. The fact that it was released tells us a lot about how things have changed. But then we're talking about the age of consent, aren't we? And that's a different thing, really. I just wonder what is the point of examining the music industry and coming to the conclusion that it's a bit vulgar and a bit crass and a bit tasteless and sometimes downright offensive, because that is the music industry. What is your alternative?
I just chip in there, because I find that Rihanna, Miley, we're empowering ourselves line a bit tiresome, because it's okay for them with their security detail and protected lifestyles, but it's that's of no help to the 15-year-old girl who's pressurized by boys to behave like girls in videos. And that's the aspect that really does trouble me, that it gives young girls and boys throughout the world a false expectation, a false reality of how perhaps life should be when you're 14, 15. And it shouldn't be behaving like Miley Cyrus did at the VMAs.
You say the industry shouldn't be behaving like that, but the music industry has always behaved in ways which the sober, sensible commentator has found troubling. I'm not rushing to the music industry's defence at all, because when all said and done, it is about shifting units. And if Rihanna's cleavage sells a million more units, then the industry will do it. It is for all the revolutionaries embedded in that business, it is capitalism writ large, the music industry. And they will use, you know, the most unsubtle of tactics to shift more units, especially at the current time when they're struggling to build a business model around records. So they're much more, you know, they're even more likely to clutch at straws like female nakedness in order to generate the revenues to which they've become accustomed. I'm not defending it. I'm just saying, no, you know, that's what you're going to get. That is what you're
going to get. What do you think of Annie Lennox's idea that she put forward that pop videos should have age ratings similar to movies, so that these the ones that she's talking about, which she calls overtly sexualized, uh-huh, would have some sort of adult rating and, you know, would be given the same restrictions as movies?
Oh, Annie, that, you know, that ship has sailed. You're suggesting that there is any kind of barrier between the viewer and the medium. There just isn't. I mean, how you know, I'm a 14-year-old lad. I hear that that Britney Spears is nigh on, you know, stark as in her new video. I go on YouTube, and before it starts, this thing pops up that says only for 18-year-olds and above. What do I do? I thought, oh, I never realised, and close my browser. You know, what? I can't. How is that policed? It's impossible. Impossible. It would achieve little or nothing.
I suspect you're right. As I say, without wishing to repeat myself endlessly, it's my concern is that it influences children who are not able to cope physically and emotionally with what they're being presented with, and it's being presented as the way they should be, you know, at 14 or 15, because Miley, Rihanna or Britney or whoever the hell else says so. But from one form of what I suppose we could call exploitation to another. I went to the proms at the Royal Albert Hall a few times in the summer. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, Magnus Shaw. Each time I went, I paid for my own ticket. And I didn't mug any taxpayers and force them to pay for me to sit in one of those swish private boxes. I actually handed over my own money. However, if I was the director of BBC Radio, that's exactly what I could have done. Helen Bowden is paid an eye-watering £340,000 per year. But during the prom season, Miss Bowden hosted parties in a private box at a cost of £8,639 to us taxpayers. One of her guests was her lawyer, Louis Charalambou, who represented Helen Bowden during the inquiry into the Jimmy Savile affair. And we taxpayers funded that lawyer. He cost us over £100,000. In total, the BBC managers spent £31,000 of taxpayer money entertaining people at the proms this summer. So it's pretty much a rhetorical question, Magnus Shaw. Will they ever get it?
Well, you know, I've not kind of reached my end of my tether with this. I mean, I would simply say to the BBC now, do you want to exist for very much longer in your current, you know, configuration? Because if you do, then you will take this very seriously and realise how this appears to the people who fund your organisation. If, however, you want to hand your enemies, and there are many of them, an absolute golden opportunity to reform you into commercial nothingness, then please carry on, because that is exactly what you will do, and it will happen quicker than you can imagine, because you are playing right into the hands of those people who think the BBC is a gravy train and an unnecessary expense on the taxpayer, and should be you know, forced into the commercial sector. You're gifting them everything they could ever dream of, and don't be so bloody daft.
this only became public due to a Freedom of Information request, and it led to us learning that among those enjoying this top treatment at our expense at the Royal Albert Hall were also, you know, they referred to a number of guests. Amongst those guests, all, by the way, in fact, 60 BBC employees, the highest paid ones, and they included Bruce Forsyth, Jeremy Paxman, Fiona Bruce, Brian Cox, James Naughty, and inevitably Alan Yentob. And they all accepted tickets for free, but funded by we taxpayers. Most brought a guest, of course. And this in the month where we learn that we've referred to this before, Mark Byford, the former Deputy Director General of the BBC, we knew that he received double his expected payoff, but part of that payoff, an additional £474,500 in his redundancy package, due to what the head of HR at the BBC described last week as an administrative error. And that led to him getting just shy of £500,000 extra in his payout. I just feel that we have to put in a freedom of information request on a daily basis to keep tabs on what BBC managers are doing. And of course, with every pound that they throw away, the BBC managers, not the broadcasters and the people on the front line, every pound they throw away or lose to administrative errors or spend on hospitality at proms concerts, each of those pounds is £1 less to do what the BBC is best at, making good programmes.
Who would argue with that? I know it's a political cliche, but you'd have to say the BBC has lost its way. And unfortunately, over and above being contemptuous of the people who fund them and the audiences that watch the programmes and listen to the programmes, they are on a suicide mission because they will be reformed in ways that they don't want. And if these people can sleep at night having conducted themselves in this way, then they're either better or worse people than I. But if they don't realise that they are actually destroying the very structure that gives them a living, then they are stupid indeed.
They're all grey people. I always, whenever I think of BBC managers and the people getting these massive salaries, they're all grey. Lord Patton, Thompson, Byford, yeah. Entwistle. Yeah. They're all kind of grey men, aren't they? Pallid,
yeah.
Grey.
Yeah, interchangeable kind of with CEOs of paint companies. They don't seem to have the flash of creativity in their eyes, do they? And if the BBC is anything, it's a creative organisation, and they don't seem to be, they don't seem to be creative people at the helm of it. And I think we can all think of people who, for a quarter of those salaries, would do the gig just for the sheer thrill of having such a creative landscape to work with, these are career managers. I don't really believe they're passionate about broadcasting. I think they're passionate about being over-rewarded executives.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter whether that is a pet food company or a broadcasting company. So I think that's probably going on as well. But as with almost all career executives, it is all about pulling down the largest amount of perks and salary. That is the end in itself.
And of course, at our expense, that's the problem.
If it is a pet food company, that is the business of the pet food company. If they want to give their CEO X million pounds a year, then good luck to them. But when it's been drawn from the public purse, you can't carry on like this, and everybody would agree. I mean, it's really not that contentious. Just whether anybody has got the clout or the will to intervene. And those who do have the clout and the will to intervene don't like the BBC. That is why they are playing such a dangerous game.
Yes, well, from the grey old boy network of the tax-funded BBC to the free market of commercial television. Because from time to time, I venture into the TV schedules and discover that a new comedy series is to be broadcast. And with trepidation, having been burnt before, I tiptoe over the fiery carpet of hot coals in the hope of finding a jewel amidst the heaving trash of experience. And so we turned to Man Down, making its debut on Channel 4 on Friday, 9:30 p.m. I emerged blinking into the commercial break at half time and realised that I'd been again to the planet of unmitigated disaster, also known as Channel 4 comedy. I'd neither laughed nor cried. I'd sat still for 15 minutes wondering how someone gets paid to commission this twaddle. this poppycock drivel, worthless, vapid pile of nonsense. Did you enjoy Men Down, Magnus Shaw?
Well, I should just say, actually, Channel 4, although nominally commercial, does attract some public funding as well.
Yes.
So perhaps this is all bundled up into the same veil of tears. But anyway, let me tell you, about 6 years ago, I had a very troublesome kidney stone. Its removal involved my torso being blasted with sonic shockwaves, an operation to have a pipe fitted between my kidney and my bladder, which then became infected. And a further procedure was then required to remove it. And the whole process took more than 8 painful months. There was a lot of blood and several stints in hospital.
Ouch.
And yet, the entire medical rigmarole gave me more laughter and entertainment than Man Down could ever, ever dream of. If you asked your pet gerbil to knock out a comedy while he was waiting for his sunflower seeds, he'd give you a script of higher quality than this pathetic waste of time, money, and electricity. Now, I've enjoyed the work of Rick Mayall and Greg Davis, who appear to be behind this travesty, in the past, but this is an insult to everyone involved, but particularly, of course, to the benighted audience who had to sit through this hopeless drivel. I now hate my television for forcing this garbage into my eyes, and Channel 4, that's your fault. Unforgivable.
Unbelievably. Because it was so awful, it was depressing, it was just gruesome. Unbelievably, it's been commissioned by Channel 4. It's got 6 episodes in this season. But having watched the 6 episodes, those responsible for commissioning it, Channel 4, said, this is going to be so good, we'll have a Christmas special that they're recording, at the last minute, because they're so sure that this is going to take off. And that, to me, is almost even more unbelievable than someone commissioning it at the beginning, because somebody actually watched this and thought, this is going to be so red hot, we'll actually impose it on people at Christmas as a special. How anyone actually sat down and wrote this and somehow believe that they've written something broadcastable, I don't know. It was just horrible from start to finish. Silly characters that you couldn't believe in, caricatures, if you like, horrible sort of inferences about people. You know, the main character, Greg Davis, gets caught with wearing his mother's underwear in a rather ridiculously contrived bit of plot, and that leads to the tailor, you know, booting him out of the shop and everything, and implying all sorts of things by the fact that he's mistakenly put on the wrong pair of underwear. Absolutely horrible. And dreadful segment. Did you notice this, Magnus? Making fun of a character in that tailor's shop. There's a young schoolboy doing work experience who appeared to have some sort of learning difficulties. They were making fun of his sort of stupidity, if you like. Mm. Oh, it was awful. I've almost got no more to say about it, because it was so grotesque and hopeless and unpleasant that I just didn't want to really make any notes about it or have a view on it. I just thought it was contemptible.
It was just incompetence, really. From commissioning to execution, it was just incompetence. And as we said before, the fact that nobody stepped in and said, you can't really be making this kind of garbage, it's just, doesn't reach any kind of acceptable professional standard, is astonishing that nobody did that. And it's unwatchable and shouldn't be on air.
It's directed by Matt Lipsey for Avalon Television. It's Man Down. It's on Channel 4 Fridays at 9:30. Let's take you from the all-too-real world of vain attempts at television comedy and move to the sublime universe of the pretend iPod, in which Magnus Shaw and I select a piece of music to join the ultimate playlist that is Ambrosia for the ears. And you can hear all of the tracks on the playlist as it has its own page on the Rocking Vicar website, and you can see all of, and hear indeed, all of the tracks that we have selected over the years, I suppose.
Ambrosia for the ears, rather, conjures up an image of rice pudding being poured,
rice pudding.
Poured into your lugholes, doesn't it? Yeah.
Stuffed down the lugholes, that's right. I love Mavericks, like Juliet's Choice last week, Polly Harvey, and my own eccentric hero, Todd Rundgren. These are artists who write their own script for life and don't allow others the opportunity to sort of edit their paths along the way. And a similar free spirit, sort of non-conformist, is Neil Young, who, like Todd Rundgren, occasionally sees the mushroom cloud of mainstream success heading his way over the hill, and immediately runs away to another planet to start over, legs it away from success just as it's beckoning. It was only by reading Graham Nash's autobiography that I learned that Neil Young actually appeared at Woodstock with Crosby, Stills and Nash, but he refused to have his contributions recorded or filmed. He didn't tell the other band members beforehand, he only told the cameraman and the director. One of the many rather astonishing revelations in Graham Nash's book is the explosion of any notion that Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young were ever any sort of cohesive partnership. And it's following Graham Nash's divulgements that I confidently pick Country Girl from Deja Vu as a Neil Young solo track. And I'll tell you why. This is what Nash says in his book, a little bit of a quote. "The scene in the studio was all kinds of unstable, a lot of cocaine. Neil recorded Country Girl in a different studio and brought in the tracks for us to sing on before taking them away again for a final mix." So in effect, it's a Neil Young solo track with Crosby, Stills and Nash providing backing vocals. Neil Young is a master of judging when songs suit a minor key, and Country Girl is a sort of shining example of this. Actually, a three-part suite made up of very separate divisions. It takes us from a shivery, doomy opening to a closing section where the sun emerges through the clouds. Sort of looking back in sorrow and looking forward with hope, I suppose. Country Girl wasn't released as a single, but the album Deja Vu was recorded July through December 1969 and released March 11th, 1970. The album reached number 5 on the UK album chart and number 1 on Billboard. And from that album, and weighing in at 5 minutes, 11 seconds, Neil Young, Country Girl.
Of course we have to have Neil Young on the pretend iPod. The thing with Neil Young is, I think you usually find people have either never heard of him or love him. I don't know anybody who knows Neil Young's stuff well but doesn't like it, which is it's quite an achievement. And of course, much like Morrissey, he's one of music's great contrarians, isn't he? And you can only get away with being that contrary if you are imbued with the kind of talents that Morrissey and Neil Young have, can't you? Otherwise, you're just a nuisance. So,
exactly. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. It's the sort of polar opposites thing. You either say Neil who, or you know he's just one of those people that you sort of adore through life for their sort of rigorous path that they set themselves, which is just of their own making. Yeah. He doesn't suffer fools gladly.
No,
say so.
No. I mean, you witness the fact he wrote a song about 6-7 years ago called "Let's Impeach the President." The little Neil Young anecdote that sums him up best is that he put down an album and somebody told me which one it was, presented it to his record company. They rejected it and the notes just said, "Doesn't sound like Neil Young." And he had a record knocked back because it didn't sound like him. So, I've got to love Neil Young and could have picked one of any one of dozens and dozens of tracks, but that's a great one. So I might have mentioned that I've just been driving through the USA for the last 18 days, yeah.
No, we didn't know.
No, no. Oh, well, I have. Anyway. And one of the joys of driving through the USA is whizzing through the FM band on the car stereo and tasting, you know, just little morsels of the thousands of stations that are available in every town and city. One thing that occurred to me is that I know people who've been refused broadcast licenses on the FM band in the UK, and Ofcom have cited the fact that there isn't enough room on the FM band for your station, your proposed station. I don't know how the FM must work differently in America, because there are just hundreds of stations on the FM band all the time in America. So somebody more technical than I may be able to explain that. But anyway, the beauty of that is that you can flick around and find all sorts of stuff from people reading the Bible in their front room to these big, big, glossy pop and rock stations. It's an absolute treat. It's particularly rewarding when one lands on a station playing songs that are really appropriate to one's location or destination. You know, America has been so mythologized that there are so many songs that describe the place you're in, that happens more often than not. But imagine my fevered excitement when I was crossing the state line from South Carolina into Georgia, and a station called Sunny FM hit me with REM's The One I Love.
Oh, right.
It's a fantastic track anyway. It's pulled as a single from 1987's soaring album Document, and it kind of marked the band's ascension from the US college circuit to the global big league and that's a position, of course, that they sealed with Losing My Religion, which was from the next LP but one, Out of Time. But really, you know, when they released The One I Love, it was clear that they were only going in one direction. There's no downside to this single. In many ways, it's the perfect REM track. Michael Stipe's opaque lyrics howled over one of Peter Buck's stunning guitar hooks, maybe his best guitar hook, actually. It's indeed arguably the best work from the band, and a song one can play over and over again without its initial thrill diminishing one iota, probably, in fact, growing every time you hear it. Now, REM, of course, were formed in Athens in Georgia, as, interestingly enough, were the B-52s. Now, when you look at Athens, Georgia on a map, which I did as navigator on this trip, it's a tiny little town, very small town. Mm. So the fact that it produced the B-52s and REM means there's some heavy voodoo in the air there, something in the water in Athens, Georgia. So I heard this on the Sunny FM, and I was just a few miles from Athens. If they'd taken a slip road off the interstate, we'd have been in Athens within the hour. So that's really exciting to hear REM when you're just, you know, a few miles from their hometown. It really is a great moment when that happens, and it really made me realise how much I missed the band. Yeah, of course, their stock had sunk slightly in their latter years, and perhaps they were right not to go on, but I kind of missed them anyway, especially when you hear a song like that. And the song is the one I love from REM. It's my pick for the Pretend iPod this week.
I like Michael Stipe. It's quite it's odd, isn't it? Because the last week or two we've had what I kind of describe Mavericks, PJ Harvey. We talked about Todd Rundgren, Neil Young, Morrissey, and I think in a way Michael Stipe fits into that category as well, as somebody who just, you know, he does what he wants.
Even when that involves painting a large blue stripe across his eyes, which he did for the REM's last tour, didn't he?
Yes, that is very unusual, isn't it? The Athens, Georgia. You're right. It's a small. I think it may be a city, but I think it's about 100,000 people.
Yeah.
The reason I know that is because I'm aware of so many bands that have come out there, like you say, REM, B-52s, also the Indigo Girls, Matthew Sweet.
Yeah, Meat Puppets. The Meat Puppets, I think, was from there.
Possibly so, yeah. You know, so it's amazing, isn't it? It's a bit like, you know, all those acts coming out of Swindon or something.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's really strange. I suppose if you've got a particularly strong art scene in a town, then you know, one success feeds another, doesn't it? It inspires other people. But it certainly has radiated out of Athens, Georgia, more than you'd expect. And of course, I believe there is still a restaurant there called Automatic for the People, which isn't named
after... Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, it's not named after the R.E.M. album. The R.E.M. album is named after the cafe.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
It's like a vegan cafe that Stipe and Buck used to go to a lot, and they borrowed the title for the album,
So is it just going off a slight tangent just quickly, I remember another act that came out of Athens, Georgia, which was called Pylon, and they you know, would mean nothing now, but they came over to the UK, and they were really good. They had a lady singer, a girl singer, and they were always playing support over here for a couple of years, sort of like late 70s with the B-52s and Talking Heads and so on. They were really, really good, and I don't know whatever became of them, Pylon. But yes, anyway, great choice. R.E.M., The One I Love, joins Neil Young, Country Girl, on the very same Pretend iPod, accessible through the Rocking Vicar website, or also on Spotify, under your name, which is Magnus Shaw.
I believe it is. And, well, there you go, R.E.M., marking the close of our little podcast for this week. It's time to draw the curtains, I'm afraid. Pop to the kitchen, bake a lasagna, put your feet up. So many thanks to Terence for his hard work and his polished shoes.
Thank you, Magnus.
Thank you, and a massive thanks to you, listener. Thank you for welcoming me back. I'm assuming you're doing that. Hey, I tell you what, we'll come back in 7 days. Bye bye.
First fall was new. Now watch the summer pass so close to you.
Production. I'm just going to carry on like the old blues singers and die on stage in Chicago, probably. I don't know. As the world knows, music has changed dramatically, and record labels have changed dramatically. Their needs and requirements have changed dramatically. So somebody of an advanced age, shall we say, finds it very, very difficult to convince, etc. But not convince an audience, but just convince the existing shops and so forth that you're sellable and stockable. So it's all very difficult. It doesn't become easier. But nonetheless, I'm still here.